This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Good afternoon and welcome to Sunday Arts Magazine on Joy 94.9.
Why are we laughing?
I have no idea, David.
Brendan Bale, hello.
Hello, David Hunt.
And how hello to our wonderful listeners out there. And let's thank the boys that did Three Chords and the Truth. The show was half decent today. Are they listening?
I haven't got any feedback from Andy.
Right.
Congratulations to the boys. And thanks for the lead-in to Sunday Arts Magazine, where we're going to be talking about all the things in Melbourne to do with the art scene and beyond.
Arty-farty.
Arty-farty. Arty-farty. With a bit of class.
Oh, really?
Well, no, not really. I can't promise that. But listeners, if you want to get in on the conversation about anything that we mentioned today, you can SMS 0427 joy949 or you can email onair@joy.org.au. Now, David.
Now, Brendan.
It is MIF time at the moment. And
right.
I've talked about it just a little bit.
Thank God it's ending.
Just a tad. And now I've got one more screening tonight of Don't Breathe.
Yep.
A little horror film that they've snuck in right at the tail end of the festival. And I'm very, very excited for this one.
Right.
It's coming out in Australia very soon.
Okay. A horror one that's coming out to general release.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
Exactly. Horror thriller from the director of the Evil Dead remake, Fede Alvarez. Which did a very, very good job on the remake.
Yep.
As you might know, a lot of remakes are hit and miss, and that was one of the hits.
And who is in it? Anyone that we know?
Not a huge name, but Jane Levy is returning from The Evil Dead.
Right.
And she's going to be starring in this one as well, and apparently put through the ringer once again. This one. So I think it might be already sold out tonight, but look out for it anyway, and I'll let you know how it went.
Now, how has the overall feel been going along to the festival? Have you been feeling that it's successful? Is most of the sessions full and or busy or?
Well, they have been, and especially sort of the horror ones that I went to, it's very heartening to see such an excited crowd for the horror offerings for MIF because, you know, they're generally, as I've mentioned in the past, in the wide release ones, they're not always the most popular, unfortunately, hence why we don't get a lot released here.
Yep.
So it is heartening to see audiences show up and really get into it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's I'll start with one called The Lure. And it's actually from Poland, and it's their first musical. It's a musical, and guess what they've done? They've turned into a horror musical.
Oh, how funny.
And
hey, you can't imagine the Polish doing horror or a musical. There would be, but they're such a serious, fun-loving, but also very serious race of people. I know some lovely Polish people here in Australia, but that threw me a little bit.
And there's a very much a dark sense of humour to this one, which I really appreciated, and I think the crowd did as well for the most part, because it's nutty, it is out there.
Fantastic.
And it's a proper musical. You know, there's these musical numbers scattered through, but, you know, they do serve the story and the storytelling part of the plot. And so I just really enjoyed it. And they're really, really catchy songs.
Right, okay.
And you've got these sort of disco, thumping kind of songs, and it slows down.
What era is it set in?
Well, that's hard to pin down. Yeah. No, it says sometime in the 1980s.
Oh, right.
But okay. I think it could be towards the end, maybe. And, you know, maybe they've just discovered disco or something. I'm I'm not sure.
Well, they would have been part of the Russian bloc in the era, so there probably wouldn't have been.
Yeah.
So it would have been probably late 80s.
Getting to there.
So, what's it called?
The Lure, L-U-R-E.
The Lure, that's right.
Yeah. And it's basically a little bit like the Hans Christian Andersen mermaid story, you know, sort of like the Little Mermaid, but told in a very horrific kind of way, but in a heartfelt and horrific way, which is always how I like my horror.
Right,
very
okay.
heartfelt.
How many?
I got to give this one 4 stars.
Oh.
Yes. I really, really enjoyed it.
Good.
And, you know, it stays on the right side of the taste barrier. You know, it could have gone really schlocky and just sort of laughable, but, you know, you're laughing with the characters and you're laughing with the situation, not at it for this one. So I really, really enjoyed that one.
Okay.
Now, sticking with sort of horror, thriller, and a little bit of sexuality thrown in for good measure, The Handmaiden. I can't remember if I talked about this last week, and if I did, I would have had to rush through it. But it is Park Chan-wook's new film, and it's actually...
Who's that?
He is a South Korean, very sort of prolific director. He did Old Boy, a number of well-respected films, but with a lot of edge to them.
Yep.
And this one is his new erotic psychological thriller.
Oh, right.
So you've already got me there. and it's based on Fingersmith by Sarah Waters. So, and it's actually been sort of transplanted into sort of a South Korean scene. And it is absolutely beautiful. It is erotic. It's, you know, bordering on the edge of sort of crazy. And I just loved every minute of it. And, you know, I actually saw a screener of this rather than going to the cinema. And I'm sad about that because I think it is a film that you really should see on the big screen.
And be with an audience.
And be with
an
audience. Yep. So, and you can do that tonight. I think there might still be standby at MIFF at 6:30 tonight as part of it. So get onto it if you really, really want to see that. It is a great film. Now, speaking of sexuality.
When we weren't.
What?
And we weren't, were we?
We were. I said what? Erotic.
Erotic. Oh well, I suppose.
All of
yeah.
that stuff,
okay.
David. Come on, keep up. Now, the two queer films, essentially, or queer male films that I've been able to see for the festival, I'm going to start with Being 17.
Coming out story? Being 17?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
God, how many coming out stories, Brendan?
I know. But, you know, I've mentioned this before, you know, it is the oldest trope in the world, you know, coming out and dealing with your sexuality at a young age. You know, there's been countless films, but it's about how you do it. And this one from Andre Tashin is beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And it follows and it stays outside of the box for the most part, which I really appreciated. You know, you've got these really well-defined characters, basically starting with Damien, the 17-year-old student who lives with his mother, but then Nathan comes along. The father, Nathan, he's away. So this Tom character comes into their lives and, you know, all hell breaks loose, basically. And then these two characters have to sort of get along. They hate each other, but they have to get along. And, you know, there is some sexual tension there and I won't let you know how it goes. But, you know, it's a beautiful story, can be quite brutal at times, but very well told. So that definitely a 4-star film for me, Being 17. But the one that's really stood out, it was Sunset Song last week. This week, Paris 559, also known as Theo and Hugo.
Oh, I like both names.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I guess you could say Theo, but I think...
No, I mean Theo. As in both titles.
Well, yeah, and when you watch the film, you know why it's called Paris 559, The Time. It's a wonderful film from Olivier Ducastel and Jacques Martineau, and they... You know, they've done some wonderful films in the past, which I've completely... Adventures
queer,
of Felix.
Queer?
And,
queer films only or just...
Not just queer films, but predominantly, I think. And this sort of charts the night, well, a couple of hours between these two characters in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And it really took me back to sort of walking the streets of Paris and seeing the romance and, you know, beauty on display just by walking down the street.
Yep.
But you've got these two beautiful characters that sort of meet at the start of the film and you sort of trace their journey.
Right, okay, over a night. Right,
yeah.
Okay.
And it's very heartfelt. I'm not sure if you've seen the film Weekend, the UK film.
Yep.
But it's sort of in that kind of realm.
Yep, okay.
Where it's sort of told in real time.
Yep.
And you're sort of following every move of these characters, you know, the highs, the lows, the people that they run into. There's a wonderful little scene towards the end where they run into a lady, I think she's a cleaning lady on the train, and she has some quirky things to say to them. And it was just absolutely beautiful. I was really just there for every moment and really identified with these characters. You know, they're put through the ringer in part of it. So, you know, for a character-driven story, queer, I don't think you can get much better than this one. So Paris 559. Hopefully it gets a local release. Obviously it won't be a huge release here, but I hope it does get...
Or it might be part of the Queer Film Festival next year.
Potentially. That would be a perfect one, because I think last night's session was sold out. So I'm assuming a lot of people would have missed out on this one. So get onto that one. And that's all for MIFF for the moment, but I might come back to it a little bit later. There, I did squeeze a lot in this week, David.
Brendan, you're never home.
I'm never home, David. Now, let us know. I did mention the numbers before, but I'll do it again. SMS 0427JOY949 or email onair@joy.org.au. Tell us your favourite film that you've seen at MIFF if you've been lucky enough to get along to the sessions, because I'd love to hear from you if it's anything that you agree with me or completely out of those.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people disagree with you with your star rating.
Well,
you're too generous.
That's every week, David. You're on Joy 94.9. It's Sunday Arts Magazine.
Joy 94.9.
Don't worry about me. Don't worry about me. Don't worry about me.
You're on Joy 94.9. It's Sunday Arts Magazine, and that was a track from France's Don't Worry About Me.
Who's France's?
I don't know, David.
Oh, okay.
You know this. I don't really do that much research about
the music.
Well,
it's not good enough.
I just love this music.
Right, okay. So how did you find her?
Well, just on YouTube.
Right.
I just get stuck in these YouTube holes and found her.
So do you go surfing, looking for music on YouTube?
Sometimes.
Yeah?
Sometimes. But it's mostly sort of propelled by me going from another artist. And
right. And because it often will come up, won't it? Other similar artists and stuff.
Yeah.
So what about the streaming services, music-wise? Do you do much of that?
No, I don't.
Right.
No, a little bit of Spotify every once in a while.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm a bit low-tech with all that kind of stuff. I'll just stick to the computer.
Or the typewriter.
The typewriter, exactly. Now, we've got a message in.
Oh, okay.
Well, I put the word out to ask about MIFF and what people have experienced this time around. A film called Ella, which I've sort of seen this, but I didn't really read much about.
Well, and interesting enough, our first guest was having a very heated debate about
this.
So
this
read
exactly.
On.
Well, it's the first Indigenous ballet star in the Australian Ballet. A beautiful journey and a great Q&A after the film with the star and director. Only chose to see films with the Q&A session.
Now, did you know about that?
Not about that one in particular.
Sounds fantastic.
Yeah, it does. It really does. But it's one of those ones I hope that does get a decent release after MIFF. You know, it gets a bit of attention and then, you know, and then more people can see it then.
Mm.
Which I think it is a great thing about festivals like that, whether it's MQFF or MIFF or the Indian Film Festival that's currently on as well at the moment. It does open it up for, you know, potential distribution if people love it and sort of are screaming for more audiences to see it then. So thank you very much. We didn't get a name with that one, but, so we've got a little bit more to go. Highly recommend it when it's on general release, a remarkable story of blood, sweat and tears from a very talented young lady.
Fantastic. Thank
Just
you
wonderful.
So much. For
thank
your
you
comment.
For your message in, and, we're going to get into our first conversation.
We've got a couple of ladies.
We've got a couple of ladies
in the studio.
We've got Lisa Minogue and we've got Josephine Harkin. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure.
Pleasure.
Now,
what is your connection with each other? How do you know each other?
So in 2012, I went back to school as a mature age student.
Mm-hmm.
And
what do you mean school?
Well, I went to a part-time night at NMIT, which has become Melbourne Polytechnic, to study photo imaging.
Right.
And my first teacher was Josephine Harkin, who happens to be sitting next to me today. And in the second week, I just went up to her and said to her, I can't do this. There was just so much information. Everybody else was nodding as though they knew. And Jo talked me off the ledge and said, you can do this. Just stick around long enough. And thankfully she's right because I'm here talking to you today. But 2 years later, Jo went off to study curating and I jokingly said to her, hey, when I do my first exhibition, you should be my curator. And here we are, people. Joe's now a curator.
Now, Josephine, tell us, you were teaching photography.
Yes, that's right. I taught for about 6 years at NMIT.
Right. So what's your background?
Oh, well, while I was doing that, I was working as a commercial photographer, and I did actually study there myself and then later at RMIT in Melbourne.
So, okay.
But, yeah, I decided to shift my practice and sort of do a sideways step and work with photography, hopefully, in a museum context. So that was my motivation in returning to
right.
study.
And now, with what Lisa's saying is that because there's so much jargon, like I tried to do a bit of photography many years ago when it was quite archaic, and I've struggled with it. And it's, because it is quite technical, isn't it? You know, all the understanding, what aperture and this, that and the other, you know, can't even think of any of the other terms. So it is quite involved, isn't it?
I think it is, but once you get your head around it, a lot of the students, that can take a little bit longer for some people, but once they get their head around it, then they
We're
start focusing on...
Yeah, talking about me.
I don't mean specifically
Lisa. Once we get her off the ledge.
You can focus a bit more on the conceptual part of your photography, which is something that Lisa actually got into very early on. She really had a focus on what she wanted to work with. And actually, the next semester taught you black and white darkroom, I think.
Yeah.
And
which, that's an art in itself,
isn't it? A real preoccupation for her was skin tone and printing dark skin.
I have a thing for skin.
She was already photographing dark-skinned people or people of a variety of skin tones. And in the darkroom, that's majorly important to get the face right so that what you're seeing is the correct exposure or what you intended the image to look like in the end.
So part of this course, so you were in the darkroom because obviously not digital.
No.
To the old school style.
No, that was only the one subject, just to make sure that was...
You have the
understanding. That's still the last school that teaches that. It does give you a fantastic background for modern photography anyhow, but I didn't stick with it. I'm a digital girl. Like you said before about the computer, leave me alone with the computer and I'm a happy human being.
Right. I'm still half and half. I could kill a few hours in the dark room every now and then. It really slows you down and makes you look at things a little bit differently.
And there is just so much art in it, as I was saying before. Have you seen, I'm sure you have, the film Blow Up?
Oh, yes, I have.
Way back in the day. Yeah, like, what a wonderful film. Yeah. And how it, and people out there, if you've never seen Blow Up, it's from the 60s. Vanessa Redgrave was in it along with David... I can't think of his name, but look up Blow Up, download it or do something and get your hands on it. And it was a bit of a timepiece of the 60s as well, wasn't it? Because he was a fashion photographer, arrogant, but the wonderful art of blowing a photo up and what unfolds there, which I won't give any more away. So what are you doing now?
So now I finished studying at Melbourne Uni a year ago, and I've been working full-time at Linden New Art in St Kilda.
Right.
And filling my outside of work hours with lots of little projects, and this is big projects, and this is one of them. Yeah.
But hold on, what are you doing at Linden?
I work as the communications and marketing coordinator.
What does that mean?
Pretty much it means social media and posters and designing flyers and calendars. And
so you do the graphic design stuff a
bit.
That's
right.
Okay.
Yep.
Because, you have an understanding for that and whatever.
Yeah.
Well, we have them on a fair bit. Last week there was somebody on so doing wonderful things. So congratulations there.
Yeah, no, it's great.
Now, let's talk to Lisa. Lisa, you're obviously a photographer.
Yes, I am. But I've started to call myself a visual artist more now because I realise I actually hold the camera in my hands way less than I hold my my stylus for my Photoshop. So I've developed over time visual artist is a better term for what I do.
And what sort of style are you working toward? Is it people or is it...
It's always people. It's one person. Usually, one at a time. I specialise in African-Australian multicultural models. Generally speaking, anyone with non-white skin.
Why?
Well, I have two Ethiopian adopted children.
Uh-huh.
I started the process over 20 years ago and found in the process of adoption, I took lots of photos of children, started working on them on the computer and realised just how much I love looking at people that don't look like me. I spent like, you know, 30-something years looking at me and all my family and that just wasn't pretty. And then, you know, I started to look at other people and I love it visually for me. And it's a challenge because photographing black skin is a completely different experience
because
to white skin.
Lighting plays a major part. I took, just with my phone, photos of dogs that I'm dog sitting. One's a white, one's a black.
Yeah.
And the black one is... it's never very good in the photos.
Ask any black person. In fact, my best friend who is in the exhibition, Atonga Molly, the first day I met her, she'd been photographed a lot and she's quite well known and she came down and she hadn't met me and I said, could you just stand there? I'll just take a photo of you. And she said, you can't take my photo in that light. You know, I'll never turn up. And I said to her, oh, I've got two Ethiopian children. I know how to do that. And she threw her arms around me and she said, oh, thank God, a white person that knows what they're doing. And for me, that was the important thing. They're in Australia particularly, there really hasn't been, you know, someone who's specialised in this. And I thought, hey, this is what I love to do. And just getting skin tones right, just making sure you're authentic to the skin tone is a big deal.
Yeah.
It's a big thing.
Now, where did the love of photography and taking it through as an art form, when did it start? Because we're talking about only a couple of years that you've actually worked your way into it.
Well, I grew up on a farm in the country and, you know, back then it was, the 70s, 80s. At 16, I was interested. We didn't have the money. Film was expensive. You had to send it away to the pharmacy. You know, it comes back four years later. Then when I was older, I got married very young.
Do you know what? Some people wouldn't even be aware of that.
No, I know. But do you remember? You sent it away. I mean, there's no, you know, instant gratification back then. Got married quite young. Was still interested. Again, it was film. My husband did buy me a camera, but I couldn't afford the film. So it was only with the introduction of digital that I was able to pursue it, you know, experiment on my own. I had no formal qualifications. And I used to joke and say, oh, when my kids go to school, I'll go back to school. But I didn't really mean it because I didn't think that be any place for me.
But the problem there is, and Josephine, you can talk about this as well, is that digital cameras aren't cheap. It's a very expensive hobby to begin with, and then an expensive art form. We had Matt Irwin on last week, amazing photographer with his love affair of Melbourne, and he was talking about lenses that cost thousands of dollars.
Absolutely, yeah. And what's your point? Oh, well, okay. Well, but other women have manicures regularly and all the other stuff. I spend my money on equipment.
But also I think what David's saying is, you know, when film ended and we started using digital, people expected the cost of photography to come down, and yet there's still inherent costs.
Like
your shutter breaks down, you've got to get a new body, lenses are still crazy expensive.
And you have to...
All the time you spend sitting on Photoshop.
Exactly.
And this one
what's your point?
and you'd have to have a very, very good computer up dating all the time, whatever, because that's the lease of
Photoshop and all the associated programs. Yep.
Oh, it's just money. At the end of the day, that's how I create the art.
We've got Lisa Minogue, artist, and Josephine Harkin. We're going to be talking about the exhibition coming up on Joy 94.9 at Sunday Arts Magazine.
Joy.
You're on Joy 94.9, Sunday Arts Magazine. We're talking everything art in Melbourne and beyond, but specifically Melbourne at the moment. We've got Lisa Minogue and Josephine Harkin in. Now, we were talking to you, Lisa, about, I guess, your process and what digital has done for you. And you call yourself a visual artist now. Mm-hmm. What kind of possibilities does that open for you when you're dealing with, maybe difficulties with light or anything like that?
Well, I was scared of studio. I started off just being a light, daylight photographer because it was so intimidating. Like you were saying before about, you know, the science of it and, you know, I was at school and I couldn't understand the ratios and all that sort of thing. I did buy myself a set of lighting and had it in a box for a year, which is a good place to keep it because it didn't get broken.
Absolutely.
And then I woke up one Sunday morning and I said to my son, I am not going to bed tonight until I have taken a photo with this lighting. So my poor boy sat there the whole day and I tamed the beast. And the minute I did, I realised studio lighting is, it's as my daughter would say, it's my bae. I absolutely love studio lighting. I love the control. And the guy, I have a partner in business or in photography that I love who went to school with me as well, Richard. He's also excellent at lighting. So you can control with studio lighting, what you can't control with nature, and I love to be in control.
Now, tell us, you've got an exhibition.
I have.
Which is called what?
The Coloured Girl.
Look how funny about that. and where is it?
It's at 45 Downstairs. It opens on Tuesday night. So exciting.
Now, so how, are they postcard size?
Oh, heck no, as if, go big or go home, as Joe says. No, they're A1 prints, but then they're framed, so they're absolutely large.
Well, how big's A1 for those who wouldn't know?
A1 is
54 by 89 centimetres.
Right.
Yeah. Enormous. Face to face. So you'll be facing my subjects with your face, same size.
Right.
Fabulous.
Okay. And why is it important to have it that big?
For me, it is about you looking, staring in the eyes at the subject and having a moment alone with another human being, although they're not staring back at you. It was very important to me that your face was at the same height as hers, more or less, and that you got an opportunity to look in the eyes of a person.
Now, the photos, some of the ones we've seen, you've got this great portfolio with amazing stuff. Is any of that in the exhibition?
Just that one you've got in your hands.
Right.
Her name's Aya.
Right, and it's a beautiful, beautiful woman. But she's got a coloured face.
She has got a coloured face. All the women have. There's 15 subjects.
Right.
That's a tong you've got there. She's pink or magenta. So it started with the story of I met a black model in 2012 at the Social Studio. It was my first real introduction into what it feels like to be a black adult in Melbourne. She was explaining to me that she'd sent her images off to an ad agency in Melbourne or a modelling agency, and they loved them, and they said to her, "We love them, they're beautiful, but we've got one of you." And now I had never heard that "one of you" thing. So I had to say to her, "Where are you from?" And she said, "Oh, Zimbabwe." I said, "Did they have another Zimbabwean model?" And she said, no, another black model. And it just occurred to me, as a white person, nobody had ever said, "Oh, you're really talented, but we've got a white photographer." Yeah. So it sort of stuck in my mind and it brewed for a while. How do I do what I do and show people who are ignorant or unknowing or that there isn't one of anyone? And in particular, let's not just lump all black people into one. So every girl has a different colour on her face.
So they're black models, but they've all got a different colour face.
Sure.
Okay.
And I was just going to ask, so that process when you're talking to the model, you know, do you make sure you do have that time to sort of get their story so you're really, you know, putting that into the image?
Oh, absolutely. So the most important thing that I want people to know is this isn't something that came up overnight and I went, "Oh, that's a great idea, let's go and find people." These are my friends. These are people I've built a relationship up with over the 4 years I was at school, and now that I have a business called Liberation Images that specialises with black people. These are my friends. These are people that have told me stories over the last 4 years.
Some of them would be tragic stories.
And really shocking, really shocking. And of course, you've got to keep in mind, I am raising two black children in Melbourne now. So for me, it was really important. When we started the adoption process, the first thing we were told was we must never tell our child's story. That our child's story is theirs to keep. So even though my friends were telling me these stories, I still didn't feel as a white woman it was mine to tell. But over time, you know, it just built up and built up. And so I came up with this idea and then sat down with every person and had a discussion about how I felt this. If I didn't know what they were telling me, and I'm the mother of two black children, most of my peers and many other people in Melbourne and Victoria will not know what you're experiencing. Can we work together to bring this,
Now, you know, children at the best of times can be nightmares.
Really? Gosh, that wasn't my experience.
And they're probably not, you know, they're probably not quick to give you praise, but, you know, have you got feedback from them about...
children?
Yeah, about the work.
Or how old are they?
Okay, so my daughter's 17.
Oh, right.
And my son is 13, but I'm so excited to tell you my daughter's actually in the project.
Oh, wonderful.
And she was the youngest, and I, that was huge for her. She's not a very public person. She chooses not to be, unlike her mother. but when she saw the calibre of the people that were in it and what I was trying to achieve, she was adamant that she put herself forward. But what I wanted to add was, in addition to the imagery, which is lovely, the stories of the women is a part of the exhibition.
So, okay.
So every woman was asked, "What does it feel like to you to be called coloured?" And they wrote a 150-word response. And that's what I want people to understand, is when you're coming to see it, you won't be just looking at my work, you'll be reading what they're going to tell you what it feels like today.
So those responses are hanging on the wall next to the work.
Including my 16-year-old daughters.
You'll be able to read that has come, I mean, that's come from these girls directly.
Yeah.
So. It sounds wonderful. And so I was going to ask you, Josephine, so when you sort of you know, when you're combining your forces together to try and create this and put it up and make sure it's the optimal experience for the audience, you know, how do you go about that?
Well,
did you reject any? Did you throw them out and say rubbish and ripped it up in front of her?
In fact, funnily enough, Lisa's actually shot extra images quite recently. So the bulk of the project was done a year ago, actually,
yes,
wasn't it, Lisa? And we haven't. I mean, it's because of the sentimental attachment that is formed through Lisa and the subject. It's really hard to ditch them.
And you wouldn't want to. When you see them, you'll understand.
How she's got about that is manipulating, I guess, the works in the way that she's developed the whole project to so that they go well together. So, yeah, we knew early on we were going to keep it at 15. So, can I just say quickly in response to your commenting on the large size of prints, the print quality of these prints is just phenomenal, even if you go to solely see that. So we've got the most amazing guy who's printed them, who's based out in Richmond. His name's
Abbotsford.
Yeah. Matt Image. And it's on like the kind of paper that you would use in a dark room. It's almost the closest thing to that type of paper. It's just beautiful.
It's luscious.
Paper.
And then they've been framed so you can see directly into the person. There is glass, but you can barely, and you just feel like you're standing in front of someone, getting to know someone.
So they are for sale.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Girl wants to make some money.
Yeah, well, that helps when you're an artist to make some money.
Yeah.
And so what's next?
Men of Colour.
Right.
Oh, boom. Once the men got wind of the women giving their opinion and all these beautiful imagery, because I haven't been backwards about it, there was a lot of men saying, hey, what about us? And, you know, what's interesting is their experience in Melbourne is completely different. A lot of times they're objectified as, you know, in a very sexual way and, you know, or big black guy, and not taking into account, you know, the brains part of it. So you'll find the Men of Colour is going to be slightly different, but I call it a sibling project. And so that's what I'm working on next, and I'm so excited.
Oh, sibling.
Well, as in, you know, you've got your girls and then you're going to have your men. It'll be similar but not the same. So
right.
I don't want to give too much away. Won't invite me back next year.
Well, lovely to meet the two of you. And can't wait to see the exhibition. Where is it again?
45 Downstairs. It opens on Tuesday, runs for 2 weeks.
Right.
And I'm happy to, I will be there giving artist talks and all those sorts of fancy things.
Fantastic. And it's called?
The Coloured Girls.
Right.
By Lisa Minogue.
Thanks for having us.
You're on Joy 94.9. It's Sunday Arts Magazine.
Joy.
Here on Joy 94.9, it is Sunday Arts Magazine. Brendan Bales, my name. David Hunt is sitting opposite me.
That's me.
I'm letting him in for the next hour and a quarter.
Gee, thanks.
Yep. And we have two very special guests in the studio.
Oh, would you call them special?
I would call them very special.
I don't know. Do you know what
bordering on Australian entertainment royalty.
Oh, steady on, fellas.
And also split personalities. They like to be lots of different people in life.
Oh,
I don't know.
We've got Pia Miranda and Grant Piero. Thank you so much for coming
on. Hello, men.
Chat.
Thank you for having us.
Last time I saw you, Grant, it was at your home doing a video, if you remember.
What were we doing?
I was there for work.
For who?
For the weekly review.
Oh, were you interviewing my wife?
I was indeed.
Oh,
and
man.
A beautiful house it is too.
And he went through all your sock drawers.
I know. Wait a moment, there's been people in my house and I wasn't aware of it. What the hell is going on?
But Grant, we want to go back. You know, you've got so much going on at the moment, but, you know, the arts, where did you sort of catch the art bug along the way? Was it acting? Was it writing? Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, that's as obvious as it sounds. I'm one of those performers now. I'm 50 now, so I've been
You're old.
Aren't I? And have been doing this for about 35 years. I joined a soap opera when I was a kid called Sons and Daughters, which I reckon lots of our listeners would know exactly what that was.
I couldn't even sing the song if you want.
Please don't.
But I was one of those kids who, you know, my nan always said, oh, he's going to be an actor one day. And it really, that's, I always was. I got my first telly job when I was just turned 16 and left home. I was living in Adelaide and left home and joined a soapy, ran away and joined the circus. And, So, you know, it was just sort of a very natural thing for me to do was to become a performer, an actor. And, you know, now after lots and lots of years, it's just as a job. It's a very mundane job for me as it has become over the years. But, of course, in the beginning when I was a kid, I was thrilled and excited. And Pia was a child actor as well. So, you know, when you first start, it's a thrilling thing for a young person. It really is. And, you know, then you get a little more stale and a little more jaded.
A few stints out of work.
Yeah, a little bit of unemployment, poverty.
Well, because that would be one of the hardest things is keeping in work, isn't it?
Yeah.
As a full-time actor.
In Australia.
Australia. And, you know, especially in Australia because the money's not as great as it is overseas and we don't sort of... I guess with notoriety doesn't always come lots of cash. So, you know, occasionally it can be a little bit depressing when you sort of got a year out of work. Mm.
Australian actors tend to go into the wilderness. You know, you'll know faces and you'll know names over a very long period of time. And if you don't hear of them, they're probably working in restaurants or pubs or driving cabs or working.
Uber, everyone's driving Ubers now at the moment.
Know, or at cellar masters. Yeah. Or...
But that's always been the case though, hasn't it, with actors? 90% of, well, there's one cafe that I go to a fair bit and all the staff are actors.
Yeah, right, right.
And so it's really quite, they're not around at present because they've got a gig. So, you know, they're not on.
It does happen too. You tend to have 2-3 gigs in a row and you're flat out and then there's nothing for 12 months. But you just have to sort of work out ways to keep yourself busy.
And not give up, on it.
Well, the fire's got to keep burning. As soon as the fire goes out, you've got to get out. Yeah. You know, if you feel as if, like when I was a child, I felt as if the industry chose me. I didn't choose it. I had to do this because that's what my brain and heart was telling me to do. And I followed it through and my parents backed me. They allowed me to leave high school to go and be on telly. And you know, it keeps calling you back. But the moment it stops calling, the moment the fire goes out, get out because it's too depressing. It's too sad to see a dream disappear in front of you. My daughter is 20 and she wants to go to drama school and she just wants to be an actor. And she dropped out of law school to do it. But her mum and I are both performers, so there was nothing that we could do to stop her.
Yeah.
So she now works at the Princess Theatre for the lovely Mariner family. And, you know, that's full of actors. The people who are working at the Mariners, all the ushers, all the bar staff, all the waiting staff, they're all performers.
Yeah.
But we're a pretty good community, so there's always someone to hang out with when you've got a few months out of work.
Yeah.
And we all tend to kind of support each other in a really great way.
Right. So my friend Kim Gingell says, Kim Gingell, who's one of my favourite actors and greatest friends, says show folk are good folk.
They are.
And they are. Yeah. They are good people, generally good people.
Yeah. So, Pia, you know, like yours, where did the bug come from?
Well, I started as quite a serious ballet dancer, actually. So I started at 2 and I really...
Wow, 2?
Yeah, I went for it for pretty much my whole childhood. So I didn't actually really have a childhood because I had a lovely childhood, but, you know, I was really working hard towards becoming a ballet dancer. And I think I got a case of good old-fashioned burnout when I got to around 16, 17. But through that time, sort of like most somewhat shy and awkward kids, I got lost a lot in old movies. I was a real movie lover, and I think at some point my love for dancing went down and my love for film and TV and acting went up, and I made that sort of difficult choice.
How old were you when you, Ella Brandy?
Oh, I wasn't that young. I mean, I ended up going to university and I did an arts degree, but I majored in drama, and I think I didn't do that till I was 24.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
on.
So I was sort of old. I'd been working. I started in Neighbours.
Yeah, right.
When I was much younger.
Right.
Yeah.
You didn't have a major part in it, or
I was on for quite a while. I was actually Toadie's first girlfriend.
Oh.
I was on there for about a year and a half, I think. And then from there, I did Ella Brandy. So I sort of was old enough. I feel like luckily I was not sort of 17, so I think that would have been a bit too much of a head trip.
Yeah.
So I was old enough. By the time it came out, I was 25, so I was sort of had luckily
and
my head screwed on.
What did that mean, having a successful film like that?
It was more of a shock for me, I guess, because it wasn't – I just loved acting and it wasn't really something that I – wanted. I sort of wasn't looking to become like super famous in overnight.
But you did.
Yeah, and I think for the group of us who were in the film, it was a little bit of a shock. And I can be quite shy in a big group, so for me, it took a lot of getting used to. Now I'm used to it, but it took a little while.
It's a rare thing in Australia. Yeah. The same thing happened to my wife in the first gig. she became very, very famous.
What was that?
That was The Pirates of Penzance.
Oh, of course.
And, it's not easy. I reckon that's a tougher gig than a gradual climb.
It was shock because it really did happen sort of within a 1 month period. But the group of us that were in it together,
but you
were going through it together.
You did have a background though. You know, like you're saying, you had done the Neighbours stuff and all that. So you were building towards it.
But a lot of people that have that sort of overnight success almost, you know, go to Hollywood and sort of think that the world is going to open up for them. But you're a little bit hesitant, I read.
Why? I don't know. I ended up going to New York actually after that and studying acting because I kind of just, I just needed a break and I wanted to get back into a classroom. So I went to the Atlantic Theatre Company and I took some time off. And then I went past LA and I did about two auditions and I just was like, I don't fit in here. This is stupid. And I just left.
You basically have to fit this crazy mold, right, of what they're looking for without any kind of difference, really, to what, you know, the blonde.
I did mine in the 80s and went to London because I thought that's what every actor did. Nobody went to America when I was a kid. Everybody went to London.
Because, look, again, now it's the whole America thing is taking off for so many Australians, isn't it?
You know? It really is. But we're like a gold mine for eager people who work really hard, and the Australian work ethic is fantastic. I think when Australians get to America, the Americans realise that these people are really determined and really work hard and work hard at, you know, whether it be going to fight school or whether it be going to accent classes or, you know, doing day classes and night. Aussie kids really work very, very hard, and that's, I think that's really attractive.
And also a lot behind the scenes, cameramen are held in very high esteem overseas.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And you're like, well, Mad Max, the latest one, all the Academy Awards it won for all the costumes, effects.
I mean, our crew is so great here. I shot something yesterday and it's just so nice when you walk on set and you're like, yep, same people I've been working with since I was in my 20s.
Yeah.
Everyone's great. Everyone's the same. Everyone treats everyone well. It's a really nice community.
The community's small enough to for us to pretty much know everybody.
Yeah.
It's kind of nice.
Now, let's hear about this new show that you both are involved in.
What?
It's,
let's just keep talking. I want to keep talking about Pia. I don't want to.
So what's it called? And it's a story that we all know.
Yeah.
It's a very familiar title.
Very familiar.
Around the World in 80 Days.
Oh, I've heard of it.
Yes, indeed.
It's a fabulous novel.
Jules Verne classic and written at the end of the 18th century. So it's quite old. It's a very, very old story, and it was science fiction at the time. And we are essentially reinventing it as a three-man show.
Hold on. Shouldn't there be more than three people in this show?
Oh, yeah.
There should. Yeah. And I only play men, by the way.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, which is a lot of fun. I've always wanted to be a boy.
So you're playing multiple roles?
Yeah, we are.
Okay.
Yeah. We all have one main character that has a through line in the story, but especially for Grant and I, we play a lot of characters.
Ian Stenlake is our third wheel.
Yeah.
Well, he's the first wheel, really.
The main wheel.
And then Pia and then I. Ian plays the very classical character of Phileas Fogg, who has a bet that he can travel around the world in 80 days, which is an extraordinary thing for the time.
Yeah, hot air balloon.
Yeah.
All of that.
We're doing it all, elephant chases.
Yes.
Trains, and we're jumping. We're all
on a stage.
Yeah, wrong side of 40, so a few aches and pains because it's quite the adventurous piece of theatre, but we'll get there.
We're essentially reinventing it so that it's comically very, very appealing. I got involved because many years ago, we created a thing called 39 Steps. A lady from England came out. Her name was Mariah Aitken, and we created a four-hander. That was Helen Christensen, Tony Taylor, Marcus Graham and myself, and we created this 39 Steps thing, and it's been hugely successful over the years. I think it might have been done 10 or more times now. And this is another one of those conceptual ideas that comes from England, where sort of out of pub theatre, a small group of people decide to put on an epic play.
Mm-hmm.
And this time there's less actors and kind of more characters. And it's, I think part of the joy of this, pardon the pun, the joy of the show is the danger of us not being able to pull it off.
Yeah.
There's an element of how are you going to do this with so few actors?
Yeah.
But Well, I don't know what you were going to, because we both wanted to say something at the same time. But look at the quality of the actors, and I'm not pulling.
I know. If
chain.
Only they could have got some.
Yeah, boom. But you have got all a pretty good reputation, and I think you're going to be able to pull it off.
We're sort of halfway there, yeah. And
that's good considering you're opening the week.
Yeah. Well, perhaps I should say we're almost there.
Yeah, yeah, we've done a lot of problem solving. We're sort of standing around going, "How are we going to make this?" And then we've sort of done it all. Now we're into pretty much about to go into just polishing it and running it.
So tell us, how do you, all the accents and all that, how are you going with that?
I thought I'm going to go out for a curry tonight because I want to do an Indian accent. And then I was in my Uber before and I was talking to the Uber driver and he was asking me where I was from. And then I said, "Where are you from?" And he said, "India." And I was so tempted to go, "Can you just read my lines for me? Can I tape them on my iPhone?" I keep saying to the other actors, "I just need to go out for a curry and just get someone to, because I just don't want to do a bad Indian accent." But luckily one of the mums at school is Indian, so she was born in India, so she did put a few of my lines on my WhatsApp. So I've been
copying
her.
The most beautiful accent.
It's so beautiful, and I want to get it right.
I like their cheeky sense of humour the Indians have that are here. I really love it. So yeah,
my very first job was in an Indian restaurant, and I worked there for like 5 years with the most amazing man in Melbourne. It was a place called Mem Sahib's. And he was the most beautiful man. So I kept trying to remember him and just try to copy him and his vibe.
I went to India and spent 3 months there 4 years ago.
Challenging?
Yeah, it was fantastic. I was making a movie there for Brendan Cowell.
Right.
And a cricket movie. And it was life-changing. It was absolutely life-changing. The most spectacular, wonderful, dangerous, exciting, sexy place I've ever been to in my life.
Yep.
And when you get off the plane and the poverty smacks you in the face, like, India is just humanity in your face. Mm-hmm. In so close.
A billion people.
Yeah, a billion people, more than. And when I first arrived, I was terrified, couldn't cross the street, I was so frightened. Well, by the time my tour of duty had ended, I didn't want to come home. And, you know, things like going to the Ganges and going to Varanasi and Bombay and Calcutta and playing cricket in the slums and...
And their love for cricket as well.
Oh, extraordinary. Yeah. But their love for each other.
Yeah.
You know, they're filled with peace in such a ravished country. It's like, it's Babylonian, you know. It's like the fall of civilization. And yet they're so at ease with each other. It's the most wonderful country or most wonderful place I've ever been to on earth. So I sucked up all those Indian accents and I kind of...
So you've got Indian you have to do?
I've got Indians and then I've got a ton of regional English accents. So Northern and Cockney and my main character has got a posh Cockney accent. So he's a bit of fun.
Do you have to take these characters home with you? Because of the limited time, you have to try it out.
Oh, that,
your son's that's sitting over there.
I've been trying them out to my kids in the bath. Like, "Mummy's just going to talk funny for an hour."
I used to take them all home, but I don't do that anymore. I leave them all at work. Yeah.
So visually, how are you going to pull it off? Is it sort of, it must be a lot of visual effects.
There's actually not. It's quite a simple set. I mean, there's a steampunk vibe, which I think is really, it's super cool, and our costumes are cool, and the set's sort of, it's quite a classic. I mean, it's a touring set, so it can't be too outrageous. But
it's traditional theatre, so there's not too much technology. There's no electronics. Everything's done manually.
Oh, okay.
Our set's made of timber, for example.
Surprisingly, there's so much action in it that you don't really need that much. Sort of,
Looking at your flyer, and it's sort of the clogs, and I believe I've seen a photo somewhere. Is that the set?
That's kind of the vibe.
Yep. Yeah, it's like the inside of a machine, a time machine, I suppose. Yeah. But all of the travel equipment comes out of the set in sort of it's secreted within the design.
Yep.
Including ships and steamers and elephants and balloons and trains and it's really a very untechnical show. But because there's so much action and because the story goes at a cracking pace, there's really, you know, I think the trickery is in the storytelling. You know, we don't need...
The script's so good and so clear and so funny.
Yeah, it's hilarious. It's really funny. Yeah. We've been laughing. Like, there's been moments of hysteria where we sort of, all right, let's just take 10 minutes off and, you know, dry
our eyes. one little bit that I just can't look at granted anymore. I can't. No, I can't. I just am going to have to.
My Indian princess.
A little bit.
Yeah. So who's directing?
Terence O'Connor is our director, very famous Melbourne director who's been around for a very long time, as much as he'd hate me to say that. He's really the reason I got on board. I'd never worked with him before, apart from Pierre, of course, and Ian.
You haven't worked together?
No,
we've never worked together.
No. Right. No.
Did you know each other? Because you were saying earlier.
Not really.
Hold on. So you both lie. You say you know everyone in the business.
You feel like you know each other.
Mutual friends. You've got a ton of mutual friends.
A ton of mutual friends, yeah.
And,
I'd worked with Ian before on Sea Patrol, but I was really sick that day. I got seasick. Yeah, I vomited.
I did a Sea Patrol too.
And vomited the whole day.
That's a good gig, wasn't it?
It was a great gig, and you get to go up to Cairns. That was so good. Oh,
yeah,
my gosh.
Great
catering.
And they
put you up in this beautiful hotel, and it was amazing, but I got a rough day on day three, I was out all day.
Yeah, I liked doing that one.
Yeah, I know.
That was good.
Yeah.
Now, are you two travelling with this production? You said it is a travelling production. So how many dates have you got?
Well, we're only doing Victoria at the moment because this is sort of our tryout period, and then we're slated to do a sort of a much larger tour for next year.
We're going to Geelong though. We're doing the Alex Theatre in St Kilda, and then we'll be heading down to Geelong.
And then there's some in the Yarra Valley and some in Whitehorse.
Yeah.
And but this is really the shortest part of it. We're sort of building the show now, and then with any luck next year it'll get picked up. I think there's sort of rumours of it going far and wide across the country, and then I spoke to the producer on Friday and they're talking about 2018 as well, but we'll just wait and see.
How do you cope with that, being away from family and it's big slices of your life? Mm. How do you cope? You've got kids. How old are your kids? Are they
One's about to turn 3 and one's 6.
Well, that's a tough time, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's tough. What do you do? Do you take them with you? Or
it depends. My partner freelances as well, so we just kind of work around. We work it out. I have family that help and friends that help, and a couple of great babysitters, and you just sort of work it out just one day at a time. Just wake up Monday, where are they? Yep, good. But I also have lots of time. I try to take time off in between gigs so that, because the gigs is so intense, especially if you do TV. I mean, those hours are really long. So then I'll take, a couple of months off just to be with them and go to netball and do all the things, and, so that they can I can refocus and make sure that they're not feeling left out. But
it's tough touring.
Yeah, but saying that, also working is so fun for me that it does make me a better parent, because I can appreciate being home with them, and I can appreciate them more because when I'm away from them,
mine are grown up, and this is a big one. I got one here in the studio with me. He's a big boy, but my kids range from 12 to 20, so they've always been aware of theatre and travelling, and mum does it and I do it, and it's it actually gets easier.
I'm at kind of that tough end of the age group that they do like it when they get to come away. That's the best.
Well, that whole behind the scenes, the stage kids, and some of the wonderful stories you hear.
I think it's an exciting life for kids. You can neglect them if you're too devoted to your work, and that's where actors have to have this real home work balance. You've got to realise that the career is just not everything. It's fun, it's exciting, it's dangerous, it's all of those things, but the most important thing is your family still, and or your friends, the people who are around you, your neighbours, all of that kind of stuff. That's just as important. Yeah. So
wonderful. Can't wait to see it.
Thank you.
Yeah, please.
I
come down.
Hear the accents.
We're very fun.
We start on the 23rd. Shall I do the plug?
Yeah,
can I do the plug?
Yep.
We're at the Alex Theatre in St Kilda, and which is a fantastic venue.
Fairly new to Melbourne, but
really new to Melbourne, but doing so great. Important.
Yep.
So important.
Absolutely.
We may be at the bar afterwards.
We will be at the bar. Yes. and we're rehearsing there too, which is great. So we start there on the 23rd of this month, which is next Tuesday week or something like that. And look, it's really a fun show. It's funny. You don't have to think too hard. It's a bit mental.
It's affordable too.
It's affordable.
Really important,
and
I think,
there might be one or two mistakes which will be a little fun for the audience.
I'm going to laugh on stage. Like, I know it. I'm just going and telling people, if you see me laughing, it's not part of the play. It's just going to happen.
And people can get tickets at the Alex Theatre website, of course. What are the dates again, David?
The dates are, it's from the 23rd of August.
Yep.
And how long's it run for?
It's a couple of weeks till the 4th of September. We might do an extra week if it does well.
And I'm sure it will, because, as I said before, it's so well known. and the word will spread that it's great and people will flock.
Hopefully. Yeah, well,
come on, Melbourne people, flock.
Flock to the theatre. Pia Miranda and Grant Puree, thank you so much for coming in. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you,
thank
fellas.
You for having
thank
us.
You. You're on Joy 94.9. I'm going to get into a song right now. This is one of my favourites. It's called Happiness from Goldfrapp. It's a bit of happiness here on Joy 94.9, Sunday Arts Magazine.
Joy 94.9.
Here on Sunday Arts Magazine, Joy 94.9. That was Goldfrapp and Happiness. I thought that would be a perfect song for today. It has been mostly sunny outside anyway.
Yes, it has been
getting
lovely.
We're getting into spring, I feel. We're getting close, David.
We are.
And we're celebrating today. We're going to keep things light and bubbly. And we're going to keep the conversation going as well. Make sure you do get in touch with us, though, 0427-JOY-949, or you can email onair@joy.org.au. And I did get a message in a little bit earlier as well, saying David was doing photography with a box brownie.
Hey, who's the smart ass?
Probably of our listeners out there.
Yes, exactly. Do you know what? A box brownie these days would be worth a bit of money.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Now, David, we're going to get into this conversation right now because we've got so much to cover with this gentleman.
Look, what an honour for us to have in the studio now. He is probably one of the most important people in the recording history of Australian music industry. And he's had such a colourful career and wonderful and very long career. Bill Armstrong, welcome today.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. I must have complimented you on the studio. It's fantastic.
Oh, thank you. Now, you really do know a lot about recording studios in particular, because you were pretty much a forerunner of everything that's really happened in this country.
Well, in some ways, yes. In Melbourne particularly, in the rock and roll side of things, little things happened in Melbourne, and I happened to open a studio at the right time, and when a guy called Roger Savage had just arrived from London, where he'd worked with Mick Jagger and all sorts of people. He had the technique of what to do and how to do it a bit better than we did, I think. And then I had then organised the structure of the studio and things, and a lot of things fell into place. And the rock and roll scene in Melbourne was about that time, the Go Show, the Commotion, all those things.
Yeah, because Melbourne's always been the main place for rock music, popular music, and it still is to this day. So what you were doing back then was quite groundbreaking, and the fact that you had these Armstrong studios in South Melbourne,
yes.
A lot of people would have thought you were crazy investing all this time and effort, and most people didn't really understand about that sort of side of
things. You sound like my bank manager at that time.
It must have been just so wonderful that you were actually doing sort of breaking ground.
Yes. Well, all I wanted to do all my life, when I was born in 1929, so I was thinking the other day, in the mood, Glenn Miller, I was 10 when that came out.
You know,
sort of when Fats Waller did his big Honeysuckle Rose. It was 1934. I've lived through all the times of electric recording electric recording didn't start till 1929 anyway.
Yeah.
And,
so how did you learn your craft? How did you learn about it? Because these days there's university courses and there's so many studios around. There wouldn't have been courses you could have learned. How did you learn it?
Oh, trial and error. And a very good friend of mine, Neil McRae, was at, actually got me a job in wiring up amplifiers in the Steen sound system where he worked. But he taught me a lot about how to circuit diagrams and one thing and another, and how to build amplifiers. And he helped me a lot, and then lots of other people helped me, and I learned a lot from them.
Yep.
And in those days, you build everything yourself.
You couldn't.
I mean, the radio stations had consoles and things, nothing like you've got here.
Yeah.
But they were pretty basic.
They would have been basic. And when the 56 Olympics, was such an enormous event here for Australia and the rest of the world. We actually got television early because of the 56
yes,
Olympics.
Yes, 56.
And you were involved in that. What did you do there?
Well, my friend Neil McRae at Philips, they had the contract to do the sound system in the main stadium. And
MCG, of course.
They needed an operator to run the system, whatever announcements had to be made and all that sort of stuff. So they gave me the job, and that was pretty good because it's one of those things when you're in the middle of it, you don't realise how great it is.
And how important. And 56 Olympics to this day is regarded as one of the best Olympics ever.
Yes, yes. And the television stations, seven... I know someone at 7 said they only had 2 cameras, I think, and they'd take them to the main stadium, and then they were bloody heavy, you know, they were very heavy, and they had to take them all down and get back to the studio to do the on-air presentation.
Did that role sort of open up a lot of opportunities for you at the time, or? Did it open up a lot of opportunities
working on the 56 Olympics?
That didn't, but at that time I was actually working at W&G Records. And I'd previously, that was in about 1952 or 3, I started my own record company, and then I went broke, and then W&G gave me a job working for them, and they bought all my equipment and my cutting machine, and I worked for them. At that time they gave me time off to go and work at the Games.
Right, okay.
And I also was monitoring the Sydney Meyer Stadium.
Right.
It wasn't a stadium then, it was, of course, the early days of the Meyer Bowl.
Yep, okay. Now, you opened the recording studios, Armstrong Studios, which went on to be, when you left them, called, what were they called later?
Armstrong Audio Video.
Yeah, and then AAV.
Yes.
Yes, AAV later down the track. Now, you had, that was one of the most important recording studios in Australia at the time. And you, how many studios were there in the
at
building?
At that time?
Yeah.
I mean, my studios were other people.
Yours?
Well, I started off at 100 Albert Road with just one little studio, which was a half a terrorist pair. So I knocked out a couple of walls, and we made one studio, which was a whole 15 by 25 feet. So that then with multi-tracking and things, we recorded heaps of tracks. Sadie the Cleaning Lady, all those things.
Right.
With dubbing on dubbing and all that sort of stuff. Progressively, I rented the same person that owned that house, and I found half the street. And whenever a house became vacant, I took it. And so I ended up with 6 studios along 100, from 100 Elbow, I had 96, 100, 110, 112, 114, and the top of a flat of 118. And I then leased a building behind in Palmerston Crescent, a 2-story building, and put an 8-track studio in there. And we had multi-track cables illegally running across all these backyards, because those days...
I would have been very primitive, I could imagine.
The PMG, if you wanted to have a connection between two houses, you had to go out through the street and buy a line from them, but we didn't do that. You can imagine. We had an 8-track machine in one studio and an 8-track and round the back, and we had to run multi-cables everywhere.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous, but...
Groundbreaking in its day, but also highly illegal and very cheeky, and that's what you could get away with back then, couldn't you?
Yes, yes. And it was... it's one of those things that when you're in the middle of it, you don't realise until much later.
Yep.
How great it was.
Yep.
Because we'd be in the middle of, we'd be at 100 Albert Road, and there'd be Farnham and Cad or someone, and we'd be having a coffee and walking along Albert Road down to the next studio to do something, and you'd think this is mad, you know. I mean, not at the time, it's what you did every day.
Yeah. Now, you were mentioning just before John Farnham and Zadie the Cleaning Lady, which was a huge single for him, and that's when he was called Johnny Farnham, and he then obviously went on, as we know, to have a huge recording career. Also, back in the 70s and 80s, Russell Morris, The Real Thing, was recorded in one of your studios as well.
Yeah, that was in Albert Road. John Sayer was the engineer, and Molly was the producer.
Yep.
and Cliff Baxter from EMI, because Molly was taking a long time to do it.
He took a long time to do
and,
it, yes.
And good on him. You know, he's a fantastic person, but yep. But he was taking a long time and irritating Cliff. And Cliff said, look, you've got to get on with it and finish it without him. So we was ordered to lock him out of the studio. But he came over the back fence. In, anyway, I mean, it's...
And there's some of the wonderful stories that you would have over the years.
Yes, yeah.
And I could imagine he would be a very naughty, naughty boy. But also within those studios, you would have done orchestras as well.
Yes. Well, in the Albert Road studio was quite small, so the only way you could do an orchestra was to record the rhythm section and the strings and the brass and then in multi-tracking them, so then mixing. And the mixing skill was by Roger Savigurn, Road, John Sayers, all those engineers I had. Fantastic. And when I listen back to it, I think, gee, they were fantastic. What they did, what their talent was in recording and mixing was something special. It's sort of like having a camera and just it's the cameraman that makes a good picture.
Absolutely. Now, back in the 60s, you met this person who is a little bit well-known around the world these days. As a matter of fact, a bit of a household name and seemed to have been backing away more and more. And his name is Barry Humphries.
Yeah.
So, yeah, how did you first meet Barry Humphries?
Well, Clifford Hocking, who's now unfortunately deceased some many years ago, and he was managing him. And at that time, at Telehill Studios in... It's down now the old Hoyts Theatre in St Kilda. What's it called? I'll think of the name.
The Alex Theatre, is
no,
it? No.
No, the...
National.
No, the other. They have shows there.
Palais.
Eh?
The Palais.
No.
I'll give up.
No, it's a small... I'll think of it in a minute.
Right, okay.
It's ridiculous. Anyway, I was running that as a studio called Telefilm in about 1960, thereabouts, and we did a lot of recordings for Clifford with Barry, and that's where I first came into contact with him, and we recorded a couple of albums. So I've known him ever since.
And that was spoken word, wasn't it?
With orchestra and all sorts of...
Right, with Dame Edna.
Yes.
Right, as Dame Edna with orchestra. Yes. We're going to play one of those tracks now.
Well, hang on. Which one are we going to play?
Fanfare for a Dame.
Oh, that's right. Now, that was recorded much... I forgot what I think. I'll have to look what date I've got on it. Anyway.
Well, here it is now.
1983.
Well, 1983. A little bit right
this
now.
Is called Song of Australia. Now, this is just the introduction, which gives you an idea of... The love of the people. If we play that, you'll understand what I'm meaning.
Oh! Listen to my Melbourne public. Hello, darling. Yes, of course, it's me. Dame Edna Everett, housewife, superstar, mother, megastar, and millionaireess. In your midst again, my little Melbourne marsupials. And I've missed you so much, I hope you've missed me. It's been nearly 2 years since I stepped athwart the boards in Melbourne. It's been too long, hasn't it, darlings? Too long! Yes, it has, but I'm back with you and I have a lovely upmarket.
So this is now available because you've remastered it all. And you put this CD out, and what's it called? It's called Song of Australia.
Yeah, it's the original recording. It's not remastered. It's the...
Oh, the original recording.
I paid the orchestra. It's the most expensive record of it. I bet to pay the orchestra because my deal with Clifford Hocking was he allowed me to record most of his people, provided if I ever put it out, I paid people.
Now, who was Clifford Hocking?
Clifford Hocking, yeah. And he was the promoter of it, and
So he would bring a lot of these artists to Australia, and he was heavily involved with Barry Humphries, wasn't he?
Yes, and so that cost me $18,000 to pay the orchestra.
Wow,
I never got that back. But however, it's a masterpiece of recording.
Yes,
over two nights and with a 130 strong Australian Philharmonic Orchestra.
Right. Okay.
And there's a bundle of those that you can
Listeners, we'll do that, but we'll do that a bit later. Now, you've also had a great love for jazz music, haven't you?
Yes, that's principally how I got into it, because I, back in, when I started my first recording company in 1949, but I grew up with Graham Bell, Frank Johnson, Bob Bernard, those bands, and of course, they like to hear themselves and I like to record them. So that's a combination where I got to know them. They would come down to my house and we had an upright piano there and things like that. And I've got recordings of them in the early days, direct onto disc. And then in 1949, I bought a wire recorder, which made by Pyrox in Melbourne, which is a, believe it or not, it's a wire, thousands of an inch diameter stainless steel wire. A mile of wire on a little bobbin.
Right.
And I actually can play you a little bit of one here. I've got it on, where have I got it on my list? Mabel's Dream, track 3 on that CD I brought in. We'll give you an idea of the quality. This is off a wire recording, not tape, made in the Melbourne Town Hall on December the 31st, 1949.
Wow. You're on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9. You're on Joy 94.9. It's Sunday Arts Magazine. Brendan Bale's my name. David Hunt is sitting opposite me. And we've kept around in the studio Bill Armstrong, a pioneer of Australian music and
Melbourne
music.
Yep.
But so what was that song that we heard?
Oh, that one was called Mabel's Dream.
Mm-hmm. And who was the
Graham Bell Band.
Graham Bell Band. And you recorded that down on wire.
On a wire.
Which you were trying to explain it to us, and Brendan and myself are still a little bit, we don't know really how you do it, but that's technical.
Sounds like
stuff.
Magic.
It really. Sounds like magic, yeah.
Yeah, it was.
At Melbourne Town Hall. That was at Melbourne Town Hall,
yes.
Right. Now, also, you've, one of the recordings you did, we were talking about John Farnham that you did Zadie the Cleaning Lady, but before that, he was actually doing what for you?
Well, he had his own little group.
Right.
That used to come and do some recordings for himself. Then David Mackay, who was producer for EMI, was working at my place doing all sorts of other things, and he heard Farnham. But also Peter Best, who was writing some commercials for Answered A&A.
Right.
Not a fictitious girl, she was a real girl, Susan Jones. It was about Susan Jones, the girl next door that's going to look after you on the plane and all that sort of stuff. And Peter wrote this beautiful music for it. And then he heard Farnham and they said, we want him to sing the commercial. So this is a recording of John Farnham before Sadie the Cleaning Lady, before he was signed to EMI, but he had else. This is Susan Jones.
Here on Joy 94.9.
Susan Jones.
Hello there.
The happiest girl with the friendliest smile. Caring for you so you're flying in style. Susan Jones. She's on every flight. You can meet her today. The happiest girl who helps us to say and say hey and hey. Cares for you all the way. Susan Jones.
That was Susan Jones in Song from Johnny Farnham.
Oh, my God. For the answer, and Bill, I actually remember that. That's how old I am as well. I remember that being on the ads. Now, tell us, because it had a bit of a Beatles feel
yes.
to it.
Well, Peter Best wrote it, and John Hawker arranged it in about four different styles. There's a couple of other styles there with brass, the Tijuana brass was big.
Oh, right.
And,
yeah.
So they had about four versions of it. If you'd like to play one of the other ones, the next track.
Sure.
Oh, very funny, yes. Wow, back in the era, it was just so, you could have fun with it, but you were also being very creative at the same time as well, which is great. So let's stick now to, because as we were saying earlier, that jazz is something that you love a lot. And you've been involved with Don Burrows, who's such a famous Australian jazz musician, and even to the extent that a week ago Australian Story did a special story on him, and it's wonderful that you've been involved in his career.
Yes, I've known Don for a long, long, long time. He has Alzheimer's, but he's with me when I see him, and occasionally. In Sydney, and he's quite physically very well, but he's lost a lot of memory. But it's interesting when talking to him, but the minute I thought after the first time I saw him, I'd ask him some things about music a while ago. Like I asked him, who did you like, Benny Goodman or Artie Shaw on the clarinet? He said, oh, Benny Goodman, because we could play like him. But nobody could play like Artie Shaw.
Right. So,
but what I'm illustrating is he'd prompt him for something and wow, all this information.
He still remembered certain things.
Such a lovely person.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's play a track of his.
I'll explain this track.
Yes, please. Yeah.
I think it was about 61 or thereabouts, Jeff Brash. You know, Brash's Stores.
The Brash's
Store, there now.
Yeah.
He was thinking of importing musical instruments from China, and he thought the only way he can find out if they're any good, maybe, is to take some people over there. So he asked Don Burrows to organise this little band to go over with him, and he took them over there, and they couldn't... The instruments were terrible. He explains a bit about it to me. He more or less said, Jeff Brash is such a gentleman, lovely person. You can't say they're crap. And because he said, Don said his James playing like there's no tomorrow, and the instrument's actually melting, almost melting or twisting.
Oh my God.
And so he ended up saying to them, Jeff Brash said to the Chinese people, look, in Australia they're pretty rough on instruments, and he's trying to get around not saying they're not very good, and he's trying to get them to say they need a stronger metal in them and things like that. However, apart from all that, Don decided that he would play some music to them, and he found out that they'd actually heard Singing in the Rain and things like that, which... and this is a recording at a concert in Melbourne. So that's the explanation, is him, and he now talks about that.
Right, okay. So this is the wonderful Don Burrows, Singing in the Rain, on Joy 94.9.
4 here, not George. George was asked to come, but I don't think he'd handle 10 days of being called Mr. Gora. So he didn't come to China. The rest of us did. And it was a fascinating trip, as you can well imagine, because as far as can be gathered, we're the first bunch of jazz musicians to actually be turned loose on the Chinese public. A lot rested on it for all sorts of reasons. So what we had to do was figure a way to entertain the Chinese people with jazz music and things pertaining to jazz. Singing in the Rain had recently reached there. No, it's interesting. They've got incredible music of their own, but the Western music has not sort of penetrated thus far. We thought, now what can we do that will certainly entertain them and be something a little different? And I thought, Len Barnard, the washboard specialist, because we all know about Chinese laundries and things. So Len has long been the virtuoso of the washboard in the Southern Hemisphere. He was our ace in the hole. What we're going to do is play for you the routine that I put together featuring Len. Here it is, Singing in the Rain.
Joy 94.9.
Thanks for tuning in to Joy 94.9 today. It's Sunday Arts Magazine. Take you through till 5 p.m.
Yes, and we've got the most wonderful person in the studio. What a pleasure that he came in today. Bill Armstrong, just the stories. We could be on all afternoon, but unfortunately we can't be. So let's talk about something. There's so much, and we're going to go back to some of the recordings a bit later. But you were groundbreaking in so many arenas. You were part of the first FM license here in Melbourne.
Yes.
And it was called Eon.
Yes.
Which is now Triple M.
Yes.
Why and how did you get involved in it?
Well, at that time I was operating the SBS radio system in Melbourne and Sydney for the Department of Communications.
Oh, okay.
And I sniffed that there was a licence application coming up for FM in about early in that year, 1980, I think it was. I got together with a relative of mine, Bill Conn, who was then head of Potter Partners, and myself, and we, between us, got together two teams, and he got the money together, and I got the technical and administration and programming side. So I got hold of a few people that were working at other stations that might join us.
Now, this was the first FM station, so this was different to AM, wasn't it?
That's
the
right.
Whole sound, everything was quite different, and you're going to be on a different wavelength and everything.
Yeah, so I got together with a number of people to be the shareholders and involved in our station. LRB was one of them. The Herald and Weekly Times, we needed a transmitter site, and they had Channel 7, of course, so we could have, you needed somewhere to put your antenna, and that helped, and also news information. We needed technical expertise, and Neil McRae, my old friend from Phillips days, had left Phillips and retired and joined me as the technical director, and Jeff Tomes, who was the chief engineer of 3XY at that time, was sneakily undercover, going to be the engineer in charge. Bill, what's his name? I'll think of his name. was at 3KZ, and I asked him to come and join us.
So you're pulling people from all other different radio and contacts within the people that knew about the technology and how to make this new like FM work.
Yeah, and we were basically, there were 9 applicants for the 2 licences, and we were basically known as the showbiz licence application. And everybody on my team was actually participating strongly in the presentation of the submission to the authorities.
Yep.
Unlike most of the others, which had solicitors and barristers coming out of their ears, we were just us.
Yep. And you knew the industry, so that's why it was an obvious one for them to use.
Yeah.
Now, so it's so amazing that, and it's now Triple M and they have Fox as well. But let's go back again. One of the, such a famous person here in Australia, well, back in the day, and he still is quite well known, Normie Rowe.
Yes.
Now, he had a song which you were involved in, heavily involved in.
What, ain't necessarily so, yes.
One of his big hits, and you actually engineered this.
It's the only one that I could crack that I actually did, because so many other things were done by younger engineers that knew so much more about recording that stuff. I was good at bands and jazz bands, and that was my forte.
Right.
But Normie recorded that for Festival Records, was produced by Pat Alton.
Right.
And we used, at that time, we had a 3-track half-inch Ampex machine, and that little click-click-click at the start of it is, I think Pat Alton or someone worked out, if you've got a match on the side of a matchbox and flicked it up now, and that's the sound you got.
Right, so that's the sound you're using in this song.
Yes, you hear it at the start of it.
Well, let's have a listen to it. Normie Rowe, It Ain't Necessarily So.
It ain't necessarily so. You're liable to read in the Bible ain't necessarily so. Moses was found in a stream.
Joy
94.9 Sunday Arts Magazine. Here on Joy 94.9, I'm Brendan Bale, and I've got David John Hunt sitting opposite me. And we've kept the wonderful Bill Armstrong around. I'm getting a Melbourne music history lesson, Australian music history lesson.
Yeah.
And that was, what was that track?
Well, it was Ain't Necessarily So, which, Bill, that was a famous song from what musical?
Porgy and Bess.
Porgy and Bess. Great song, and what a great singer he was. A lot of this music, the Dumbarrows tribute albums and the live recordings, you can buy at JB or Thomas's, but just Google online and you'll find out all about them. And the Barry Humphries one, Dame Edna ones as well. But just Google Bill Armstrong, and to find out so much wonderful information about this man. Thank you so much for coming in today. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today.
All right, David. Thank you for being in here. It's I must admit, it's a great setup, and I'm very proud of the public radio stations, because in my histories of things, I was vice chairman of the Broadcasting Authority.
Oh, wow.
So I was actually one of the people on the other side where people came to renew their license.
Right, okay.
And I always renewed them. But quite often, a lot of the people on the staff there were thinking people should do more for the news people. And
yeah.
I'd say, look, do you know what it costs to have a news person?
Oh,
another
yes.
80 grand
yeah.
a year.
Yeah, well,
and things
but
like
we've
that.
Got we've got the most wonderful newsreader who will be reading the news soon, and he's a volunteer.
It's an absolute bargain.
Yeah, he's a volunteer. well, he thinks he's good at reading, and we reckon he's
all
great.
All I'm saying is I've got an idea what places are like
absolutely.
And how well they're running.
Yeah.
And this seems like a pretty good setup.
Good on you. And from an expert like you, I really appreciate it. So thank you again for coming in. It was an absolute pleasure. We're going to go out with just a little bit of a snippet
We're going to leave you the real thing.
Russell Morris, which was produced by Molly and recorded at Armstrong Studios.
Yes.
Bye, everyone.
Bye. See you next week at Sunday Arts Magazine for another week.
can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.